Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Today we are the OIG Coffee Table. We're the OIG Coffee Table. Wade, conflict, not able to make it. But I guess this is Matt, this is your way of getting back at Wade for missing last week.
That's right. Yeah. You tried to Wally Pip me by putting in Gene Stone.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, we tried that.
I'm surprised I ever got an invite back.
Yeah, we tried that. I mean, she is a national treasure, so you clearly have it's the gladiatorial round table. You and Wade and Gene are all battling for your seat at the, you know, at the Knights of the Round Table. I mean, you guys can work that out yourself. I mean, I know where my place is. The guy that hits the record button. So it is what it is. So anyway, we're here. Matt Kachansky, retired special agent charge from the OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and my counterpart, of course, as senior director here of our payment integrity team. And so, a couple weeks ago, there was a press release that came out, and then there was a little bit of an analysis of it. Back in April, an organization by the name of Expert Wound Care out of California, Medicare billing, crazy, $46.6 million in 7 months for skin grafts. And we know that skin grafts are becoming the flavor of the day. We're seeing a lot of these cases involving skin grafting and some of the issues involving either a lack of clarity of the policy or a revisiting of policies and things of that sort. So I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. But what was interesting is over $46 million in billings in a 7 month period, services that weren't performed. But the thing that was interesting was the spike. There was this tectonic growth over that 7 month period. I'm just looking at some information now that says from July of 25 to March of 26, they averaged about $37,000, almost $38,000 per claim, more than double the national average of about $16,000. So that should be your first flag. And then the real one for me was in July of 2025, it was about $4,900 in Medicare billing for skin grafts, and it went up to $33 million in December of 25, and their utilization rates were off the charts. And then finally, one of my favorites is when you look at the individual beneficiary contributions, one beneficiary, $6.2 million for one beneficiary alone, when the average amount for a beneficiary is about $300,000. So, you know, a bunch of red flags over the 7 months. And when I read this, and as I mentioned to you, one of the first things that came to mind for me was how reminiscent this was of the catheter case, the incontinence case, particularly with respect to the fact that if you remember, one of the companies had previously been a supplier of wigs for chemotherapy patients in primarily the Medicaid space, doing $50,000-$60,000 a year in business. And now it's, you know, in the millions, and you know how that red flag comes about. But this one, obviously, tons of red flags. The good news is it was caught within 7 months. The question is, how is it only $2 million was seized in $46 million in billings? And obviously, the amount of reimbursements are not always going to align with each other. But it does show a couple of things. One, for me, it showed that the use of data is getting stronger and better because it was uncovered in 7 months versus 7 years. We don't know what data analytics tool they were using. We don't know who was the uncovering organization. Was it OIG? Was it CMS? Was it one of the UPICs? But either way, regardless, it is good to know that, you know, this got caught within the 7 months. Skin grafts are becoming a big thing. But Matt, you know, data, this is one of those examples where data-driven fraud, proactive data analysis is going to help you with being able to determine not only the current fraud schemes, but where things may be trending, right? Skin grafts, and by the way, skin grafts are not something that's new. I think the problem is that we get tired of hearing about these things and then seeing that it's taking so long to kind of catch up to the schemes themselves.
Yeah, the analysis of data is always going to be behind the fraud scheme itself, but the 7 months shows that that gap is narrowing, and that's a wonderful thing to see, that data is becoming a more used tool to proactively find these things. And I think that's great. And I know the administration has been pushing that data platform. I can't remember what the name of it is. It's similar to the having all the data come into one place at one time and having anything else. That's, you know, that's a great idea. And if it works, it could really, I don't say minority report this thing, but you know, it could be to the first few weeks or months that these claims start to spike, or there's an anomaly, there's enough eyes on it and enough tools being used that it's going to pop up much quicker. And also, you know, they can start building predictive analytics in there as well to find the you know, what are the characteristics of a scheme, you know, spikes, lack of, you know, small number of referring physicians and these types of things, beneficiaries that are spiking, you know, with individual claims,
right,
and start using those types of indicators to find things as they're beginning. And I think that's the way to go. It's pushing the investigation to the left more and more towards the beginning of it to stop it before it really gets started. And I think that's the true goal of a program integrity entity.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think when looking at this, the first thing that people might think about is, well, if the data was so obvious, why did it take 7 months, right? We used to sit and say, why did it take 3 years? Why did it take 2 years? Now we're saying, hey, why is it taking 7 months? And if we use the, you know, the premise of to the left, meaning the early stage, the question becomes, why did it take 7 months? And there's a whole host of issues. Number one is you're reliant upon the provider submitting those claims in a near real-time fashion to get to that front stage. What a lot of people don't think about is providers may not submit claims for certain insurance plans. Maybe they do it once a month. Maybe they do it every other week. These aren't necessarily real-time or near real-time submissions of claims. And that's going to create an inherent delay, which I think is the piece of the puzzle that oftentimes people don't think about.
Yeah, absolutely right. You think about things like ABA therapy or other types of physical therapy. They're billing once a month for large numbers of claims for their patients. So you don't see day-to-day billings for them. And sometimes with something like this wound care stuff, maybe the wound care is taking months with the patient to really, you know, they keep using more and more of the wound care kits to heal the wound, if they're actually doing them. And so maybe it's 3 or 4 months of claims being submitted at the end, you know, when the therapy is done. And so you're not going to see, you know, daily routine claim submission.
Right. The alternative too is that sometimes providers are going to hold claims back because they think that by holding the claims back, they could spread them out a little bit more, sprinkle those claims, and then reduce that potential exposure. I mean, I remember working on a podiatry case, oddly enough, where the podiatrist, this was back, there was a period of time where, as you may recall, if you submitted a claim after 12 months, it was at a reduced reimbursement rate. You had 18 months to submit a claim, and after 12 months, it was a reduced amount. Well, this provider would intentionally hold claims back and submit them after 12 months so that he was kind of sprinkling the claims. But also, you know, I think in his mind, he was taking the position that if I am taking a reduced amount of money, no one's going to look at me for that. And, you know, he would do his batch claims that would be so delayed, like literally be over 12 months. That policy is now gone. You have 12 months to submit a claim, and after 12 months, there's no reduced payment. You just don't get paid for it at all. But I do think that for the providers that are intent on doing this, that's one way that in the provider world, there's a belief that by holding back the claims and submitting them in a delayed fashion, that you're going to, you know, reduce that potential liability. I worked on a self-disclosure a little bit ago where the provider was billing for, we've talked about these tests before, the transcranial Doppler. He's an ophthalmologist. He was billing for TCDs, and he was doing them on every single patient. And he knew that he shouldn't be doing them on every single patient because he was following the guidance from the manufacturer, which told him what the primary diagnosis was to do it. And he recognized that that was going to create a spike. So what he started to do is he started to bill them under the NPI of his brother, who was a part-time ophthalmologist in his practice, who never did a single one. But his feeling was that if he moved some of those claims to his brother, it would level set that bell curve that, you know, would that was there. And I think that's where some of this comes in, is that there's a combination of these manipulation of the timing of when you submit the claim and things of that sort. This case, I thought was good because, you know, in 7 months, they were able to get it shut down. We see $46 million in billings. We see $2 million that has been seized. You know, the question is there more out there? Was it $46 million in billed, $2 million in paid? From the reading, I couldn't really tell, you know, what was the case. But certainly when you're seeing one beneficiary with millions of dollars in costs being associated to them, that obviously raises the red flag. From an investigations perspective, that becomes witness number one.
Right. Yeah. You go to that person, find out, were they a burn victim over 90% of their body? You know, you see, you know, did they get the treatments? Who, you know, do they even know this provider? Do they have this type of skin grafts? And yeah, that's how you build the investigation. You take that data as the lead and you use it to inform an investigative plan that's going to get you to the truth as soon as possible. You know, and that's, you know, and that's another reason why data being used this way is shortening that length of time between the fraud and its exposure.
Right. And that becomes the key. And I think using your analogy, the key is to move your investigation as far to the left as you can. Right. That's the beginning, right? If we're looking at this as a timeline, right? We're not talking about left political. We're talking about left, shifting it to the left from a time perspective, beginning to end, left to right, that when you are looking to shift things over to that left side, it's getting in front of the things that become the problems early on. It's a little bit like right now, you know, the nomenclature is not really in prepay. The nomenclature is in stop and verify. And how do you stop and verify before prepay, right? How do you put the brakes on in a short enough period of time to not let so much money go out the door, but also remain within your statutory and regulatory and policy related must pay rules, 14 days or 30 days, depending upon where you are in the world. And so moving that investigation as far to the left as possible, particularly in a proactive environment where you're seeing some of these spikes, who, you know, we loved, and I always loved using, and even today we use a lot, the top 10. Who are your top 10 beneficiaries or members? Those should be the people, when you see a case like this, those are the ones you have to start with. You don't want to start, you know, don't go randomly looking at people. Targeted interviews of those top 10 people, the number one beneficiary is probably going to have a lot to say about that $6 million.
Right. Yes, absolutely. And using not just billing data, but using other data sources available to you, whether that's Secretary of State information, the enrollment documentation, to see if there's connections between this provider and other ones that have had a PI history with your plan or others, because it is a wealth of information out there that you can use, most of it free of charge, you know, to find these types of business connections, whether that's, you know, resident agent, common addresses, common, you know, even common, you know, referring physicians with other companies that in the past that were doing the same thing, therefore identifying this new scheme much quicker. So right. You really have to have a thorough investigative plan in place to cover all of these avenues.
Well, and the one thing that kind of stood out was that a lot of these were services not rendered, in part because they didn't have the material. So the challenge is unless you know who the supplier is, getting that information can be a challenge, but the services not rendered piece can be corroborated through the interviews with members who will tell you, well, no, I've never been there. I don't know this doctor. I don't know this referring doctor. I don't know this ordering doctor. I don't have 90% burns over my body, which in that 6 month period, those wound kits, you know, you would have accounted for that. And that's where in that payment integrity space on the SIU side, going and talking to a medical director to say, is it even possible? Like I remember, you know, when we were doing a lot of these cases involving the 5% lidocaine, right? So 4% you could buy over the counter for $8, $9, but the 5% version, you know, you're talking hundreds of dollars, you know, a tube. And when you speak to members and you find out that they're getting 7, 8, 9 tubes a month of lidocaine, and you speak to a healthcare, you know, a doctor, and the doctor will tell you, you know, this is insane. They would be slathering themselves from head to toe with this ointment. Or a pharmacist. And I remember talking to a pharmacist where the prescription was something like, you know, whatever the amount was, grams, you know, 0.2 grams, you know, a dollop, you know, whatever it may be, a quarter size twice a day. And you know, you say to a pharmacist, how much of that will you know, one tube will cover the entire body. And then they're getting 7 tubes, right? So those are things that come into play when you're talking about these wound care kits, and you're talking about the size of a wound care kit that's based upon the billings. And then you're saying, okay, what would the patient have to have to need this volume? And yeah, it's things like 90% burns or whatever it may be. But then you go back and you look at those top 10 beneficiaries. What's the diagnosis that got them that wound kit? Do they have a prior history of that diagnosis? If someone has severe burns on their body or diabetic wounds untreated, what's their prior history? Do they even have a diagnosis of diabetes? Do they have a prior diagnosis of diabetic neuropathy? Do they have a prior diagnosis of unstable or untreated open wounds? Like some of these things where it's, you know, and I know I've talked about this on some other cases. There was G0166, external counter pulsation, where you have to have unstable non-surgical candidate angina. And the very first day that the person gets that service is the day that they have that diagnosis. Prior to that, they have no diagnosis for it. It never existed. And then miraculously, they not only get that diagnosis, but you know what? There's a treatment we can give you on the very same day. And it just doesn't seem right.
Yeah, we just did for one of our clients, we did a claims history study where they were pre-authing GLP-1s. And we looked through the claims history of the members that were now getting these GLP-1s, and not, you know, there was no indication of diabetes or anything like that that would allow for the coverage of it until the day that it was prescribed by the,
or even a comorbidity of obesity.
Right. Nothing like that. And, you know, we looked through 10 diagnoses for each claim that they had ever had submitted for them, and then none of them had it.
Just someone looking to get a little bit of the Skeletor going on, that, you know, the gauntness. Kelly Osborne comes to mind. Like, you know, you can't even tell it's her anymore from that. But yeah, I mean, these are great examples where, you know, we're taking something that's the known skin grafts, then you look at some other things that are your high dollar costs, and then say, where in their history, just from the data, do these people have a history that supports today's modality, yesterday's diagnosis for today's modality, or yesterday's diagnosis for today's treatment regimen? And, you know, I would surmise that in a lot of these cases that where there's going to be a disconnect. I mean, you, me and Wade have talked previously about ICD-10s being the redheaded stepchild. Everybody focuses on CPT and HCPCS codes, but ICD-10s can give you a lot of information that you weren't really thinking about at the time. You know, and I say, just from a data perspective, what are your top 5 or 10 ICD-10s that your plans are paying for? And then as it relates to that ICD-10, what are your top 5 or 10 CPT or HCPCS codes that are linked to that? And are those ICD-10s historically for your top 10 beneficiaries for that CPT, that ICD-10, do they have a history of that? And that may give you some clues as to some things that are percolating up as problems that you don't even realize exist, because maybe providers are testing the water or something, you know, something like that. Who would have ever thought that the GLP-1s, where, you know, their intended use is for, you know, diabetes related. And then obviously, you know, as you see in the commercials, and I could lose a little weight. Remember, those are the commercials. Now it's like, hey, I'm going to lose a little weight and I don't have diabetes anymore. right? Like that's, you know, kind of
A1C happens to be down as well. Yeah.
Right, right. Where it used to be, my A1C is down and I lost a little bit of weight. Now it's, hey, I lost a lot of weight. And guess what? My A1C is also down a little bit. So, you know, I think there's a little bit to that.
Yeah, there's absolutely a lot to that. And if you look at the most revenue for pharmaceuticals, it's the ones that are on TV now, whether it's the GLP-1s or the psoriasis right. medicines and all that. Those are the biggest selling drugs.
Right. Well, it's always right. Us, United States, and I think Australia, I think there are only two or three countries that allow direct to consumer marketing. And so, you know, that becomes the thing. You call your doctor up about something that you want, not necessarily something that your doctor may be thinking of as part of your medical care, but it's the direct to consumer factor that's out there that I think creates that collateral piece of the puzzle. But it is interesting to see that. And I know that, you know, there have been some cases where there were some cases involving the manipulation of average wholesale price and artificial inflation of that. There was a case many years ago involving a company called First Data Bank and the manipulation of average wholesale prices, you know, in the way that some of that stuff was done. And when you looked at it, it was the top dispensed or prescribed drugs that weren't under active marketing were the ones that had the largest manipulation because they were under the radar. No one was looking at them. They're widely prescribed, but no one is doing an ad campaign for them. And those were the drugs that are under the radar. So you bump up the price 5% a little bit, you manipulate that price, that AWP goes up, reimbursements go up, you know, all that other stuff becomes collateral, but it's in the same vein as, you know, your direct to consumer stuff is stuff people are looking at. So everybody's looking at the GLP-1s now, just like everybody's looking at the skin grafting and skin substitutes because the money is, you know, so the question of why do you rob a bank? Well, that's because that's where the money is. And so it's no different. You know, why would somebody be looking at a low reimbursement item, service, or procedure that the juice may not be worth the squeeze on? So, yeah, I mean, you got
to
look at
back to the original thing of how are you staying under the radar as a provider? You know, whether it's delaying the submission of the claims,
right,
putting them under your brother's NPI, or maybe you're looking at, you know, what procedure codes are really not being focused on and, you know, bill that way.
So right. Exactly. It's like, what's the suite of things that are interesting to me from a money-wise perspective, but no one really cares about, just kind of the way it is. So interesting.
Catheters,
so
$7 a piece.
Catheters. That's right. Catheters, diapers, $7 a piece. So it's an interesting case. Take a look at it. There's a lot of stuff written about it online because it is a very data-driven. It was a very data-driven case that resulted in, you know, in a good resolution. Hopefully we'll start to see some more of these as the analytics starts to become a little bit more time attuned, we'll say. But it's always going to be predicated upon when those claims go in. You can't force a provider to submit a claim earlier than you would want them to. And again, we've talked about this a lot relative to DME or genetic testing and E&Ms, right? Unless there's a tectonic shift in the timeframes by which these things can be submitted, we're going to always be in this data matching black hole until there's a real time between those two things. So this is a good example. 7 months is pretty good. And we'll see if that time frame tightens up as the analytics get a little bit better. And we also get better at understanding what some of these fraud schemes are. So, you know, good food for thought. ICD-10, CPT, HCPCS codes, don't ignore the ICD-10s. They aren't the redheaded stepchild the way they used to be years ago. They are a piece of the data analytic continuum that we should be looking at. So good stuff. Wade missed out. Sorry. Maybe not sorry. I guess, you know, we'll see when he and I guess next week he and Gene Stone will be having a gladiatorial combat, jousting and the like. And I guess we'll see where, you know, where that goes.
That could be the session.
It could be. My money is on Gene Stone. Just saying.
Absolutely.
My money's on, she's very feisty. If you know Jean Stone, you know she's very feisty. So Matt, as always, good stuff. Good to connect up with you. Glad you're back from vacation. And again, LinkedIn Lives, we've got a whole bunch planned. So take a look at those on LinkedIn, see what we got going on with that. The newsletter every week. comes out, sign up for the newsletter on our website, hit Spotify, hit YouTube, subscribe, and we'll see everybody on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.